Catch the NBA playoffs on Sling TV, the most flexible live TV streaming service, putting consumers in control to watch games their way with flexible subscriptions. Want to catch one game or a full series on ESPN? Grab a 1, 3, or 7-day pass. If you want to catch as many games as possible, get a monthly subscription with our ABC, NBC, and ESPN combo package. Either way, Sling lets you watch the playoffs your way with no long-term contracts. Learn more at sling.com.
Previously on What If They're Wrong After the Accusation.
I'm hoping this come to an end, Amber. I'm tired now.
Elwood Jones is a murderous bastard.
In your opinion, was Dr. McDonough wrong about the Eichenella infection?
Absolutely.
And doctor, to you, is this a matter of opinion?
I mean, his where he was wrong was actually, he was factually wrong.
Today's a pretty important day. Just moments ago, I dismissed the case against Elwood Jones. This is the result of a months-long intensive review of trial paperwork, of court filings, of evidence. I came to the conclusion that there is a lack of evidence, both physical and forensic, tying Mr. Jones to the murder. Trying this case anew would be futile. We just don't have evidence to prove Mr. Jones was the killer.
When Jay called, I got up and I went in and told my sister, I say, I'm free. She didn't understand what I meant by that. And I said, Jay just told me that she had dropped the charges against me. And she said, thank you, Jesus. I say, yeah, I tell my mother.
In mid-December, after Hamilton County Prosecutor Connie Pillage dismissed murder charges against Elwood Jones, a man who had spent nearly 30 years on Ohio's death row, former prosecutors who handled the case did something remarkable. They declared publicly that the new prosecutor was either ignorant or a liar. On December 17, 2025, former prosecutor Joe Dieters, now a sitting Ohio Supreme Court justice, spent an hour on Cincinnati's most popular conservative talk radio show defending a murder conviction that no longer exists. With him defending the conviction was Mark Pietmeyer, the original trial prosecutor. 5 days after Pillage's dismissal, they attacked her decision and insisted Jones was guilty. Then, as phone records I obtained show, things got even more unusual. The day after that radio appearance, on December 18th, Dieters had a 10-minute phone call with Hamilton County Coroner Lakshmi Samarko. Text messages that morning showed they discussed case-specific evidence, which witnesses from 1994 were still alive, and whether hospital samples still existed. 4 days later, on December 22nd, Samarko made a stunning public announcement. She said she found a document within the case file that showed Rhoda Nathan, the murder victim, had tested negative for hepatitis B, contradicting medical evidence that was central to a judge granting Jones a new trial and the reason Pillage not only dismissed the charges, but said that Jones was medically excluded as the killer. Phone records show Samarko gave current prosecutor Pillage just 13 minutes' notice before releasing that statement. A statement, by the way, that proved to be false. About 24 hours later, facing legal pressure from Jones' defense lawyers, the coroner walked back her supposed discovery. It turned out that the negative test result she had announced was actually Elwood Jones' test, not Nathan's. Nathan had tested positive all along. But the damage was done, and the communications reflected in these records raised serious questions about how the coroner's office handled this moment. Welcome to What If They're Wrong After the Accusation. I'm Amber Hunt. Now, if you had trouble following that cold open, let me sum it up here. Records I obtained by filing a Freedom of Information request show that Hamilton County Coroner Sammarco talked to Joe Dieters, a sitting state Supreme Court justice, about a case that he originally convicted and which has come before the state Supreme Court. The records also show that Sammarco's office discussed the case with Pete Meyer, who's retired from the prosecutor's office as of last year. But Sammarco did not tell the sitting prosecutor, who, by the way, is a fellow Democrat, in case you were wondering, about the grenade she was about to lob in the public's perception of the case until 13 minutes prior to the lobbing. All of this is, shall we say, unusual. If you follow my work, you'll likely know I've covered the Jones case for years. I began my reporting on it in 2019, and it was the focus of season 4 of my podcast series Accused. I've continued following it through What If They're Wrong after the accusation as an independent journalist with my partner Amanda Rossman. As we discussed last episode, Pillich on December 12th dismissed charges against Jones and stated publicly that she believes he's innocent. Rather than accept the dismissal, Dieters and Pete Meyer went on Bill Cunningham's local radio show to attack Pillich's decision, question her competence, and continue to insist Jones is guilty. I admit I predicted this would happen, although I kind of was joking. Here's me talking to Pillich after a December 12th press conference.
I wouldn't be surprised if I heard Dieters on the radio later saying that this is a political decision and a mistake. You had some of the prosecutors who worked this case initially working beneath you even just this year. I mean, so how do you deal with that? And what's it going to do within the office?
Well, look, there has been a cultural change in this office. And those who did not want to try to focus on justice with integrity, they left before I even got here. We had a couple more people leave after that. But we also have some amazingly strong lawyers in this office who are committed to serving the public. This is the leadership that I bring. And I'm confident that the people who work for me want to serve in this manner.
A few minutes later, I joked,
but you'll be listening to Bill Cunningham later today. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I think he's on in the morning. So he's got all weekend to put it together.
Well, I'm not an avid listener.
So. Yeah, I don't have time to listen to stuff like that. I come in early and stay late.
So I wasn't surprised they went on the radio. What I was surprised by, what compelled me to request the phone records, was the coroner's announcement coming so soon after, echoing the exact arguments Dieters and Pete Meyer had made on the air. I debated writing this episode because I'll be accused of being an advocate or being too close to the case. I want to be clear. I still don't know who killed Rhoda Nathan, a 67-year-old widow who, by all accounts, was a lovely woman and grandmother adored by her community. If new evidence comes forward implicating Elwood Jones, I would still weigh it, even though he can't be charged again in this case. After more than 6 years investigating this murder, my stance is simply that the conviction was problematic, that leads pointing to other suspects weren't pursued, and that prosecutors seemed to get tunnel vision. I'm not too close to the case. I'm simply well-informed. And what these phone records show is something I think the public deserves to know. When it came time to review evidence and make announcements about this case, the coroner appears to have coordinated with the former prosecutors who disagreed with the dismissal, not the current prosecutor with actual authority over the case. Let me walk you through what happened, starting with what Dieters said on the radio about the hepatitis B evidence. I always worry that this part of the case is difficult to understand, but here's the gist. Elwood hurt his hand the morning Rhoda was killed, and that injury was cited as proof he killed her because a hand surgeon testified during the original trial that he had only ever seen that type of closed fist injury in relation to what's called a fight bite. In short, human mouths are gross, so if you punch someone in the mouth so hard that your hand gets cut, their gross mouth bacteria can get into one of your finger joints, which is an ideal place for bacteria to thrive. Elwood's cut got infected, and tests showed that within the bite, there was a bacteria called Eikenella choroidens, which the hand surgeon said is only associated with people's mouths. But Pillage noted that Rhoda Nathan had an active hepatitis B infection, and an infectious disease expert, someone far better suited to speak to bacterial infections than a hand surgeon, testified in August 2022 that Eikenille accordans is not only found in the mouth, and also, Hepi is way more transmissible than it. So if Elwood got Eikenille from punching Rhoda, he most certainly would have gotten a hepatitis infection too. Hep B can take years of dormancy to show up, but at this point, 30 years after the murder, Jones does not test positive for even the antibodies, which means he's never had Hep B in his life. Here's how Dieters dismissed Pillage's mention of hepatitis B.
She's further stated she's cleared him because of modern medical scientific evidence. I don't know what she's talking about. If she is talking about hepatitis B, the defense's own witness in his request for a new trial said there is about a 33% chance of him getting that by punching her in the mouth. So it's not, how can you exclude somebody when there's a 70 or 67% chance that that could still be true?
This fundamentally misrepresents how medical exclusion works. The 33% figure Dieter cites appears to be about needle sharing, not the kind of violent facial trauma their theory requires. The infectious disease expert testified that you can't claim the contact was intimate enough for bacterial plaque embedding, but not intimate enough for viral transmission. And that's not how biology works. That's why Pillage called this medical evidence exclusionary. And then, 10 days after Pillage's announcement, the Hamilton County Coroner's Office announced its big news. On December 22nd, Coroner Lakshmi Samarko said that a review of archived records revealed Rhoda Nathan actually tested negative for hepatitis B. The 1994 autopsy stating she had hepatitis B, well, according to Samarko, that was the result of, quote, human error in transcription, end quote. Now, the timing of this was remarkable. The hepatitis B evidence has been accepted in Elwood Jones's case since the beginning. That's why he was tested way back in 1994 to see if he had contracted it from Rhoda. And it's been central to his innocence claims since 2022. It was, indeed, a key reason Judge Wendy Cross granted Jones a new trial. Pillage explicitly cited it when she dismissed the charges on December 12th. Then came a weekend of radio attacks from Joe Dieters and his allies. And on Monday morning, the coroner, who had worked alongside Dieters for years, announced this supposed reversal. The pathologist who conducted the 1994 autopsy is conveniently dead, so he can't speak to things. But the phone records I obtained show something notable happened in the days leading up to Samarko's announcement. Call log records show that on December 18th, 2025, the day after Dieters and Pete Meyer went on the radio defending the conviction, Dieters and Samarko exchanged text messages that morning about case-specific evidence. First, Samarko told Dieters in a text to call her landline. Then, via text, they discussed who from the 1994 investigation was still alive, presumably to potentially interview. Samarko wrote that Cleveland, meaning Dr. Frank Cleveland, the former Hamilton County coroner, responded to the scene, but a Dr. Gerber did the autopsy, and he has since died. She noted that Dorothy Dean, who had assisted with the autopsy, was still alive. Then Samarko and Dieters discussed whether Bethesda North Hospital, where Rhoda Nathan's liver tissues would have been stored, still had those samples from 1994. Samarko told Dieters, quote, B North retention is only 10 years, end quote. In other words, the samples were gone, destroyed years earlier. Then, at 11:25 a.m., Dieters and Samarko had a 10-minute phone call. I emailed Samarko and Andrea Hatton, the chief administrator of the Hamilton County Coroner's Office. I asked them what that 10-minute phone call was about. Samarko replied, saying that my question was quote-unquote irrelevant and had already been addressed. I replied that it hasn't been addressed. I just received the phone records, after all, and asked her what precisely about communicating with the sitting justice about a criminal case was irrelevant. She never replied. I sent a follow-up FOIA request asking for access to landline calls between Sammarco and Dieters, but Andrea Hatton said the office doesn't keep those records. I made that request because in one of her text messages to Dieters, Sammarco told him to call her on her landline. I'll note here, too, that I emailed Dieters about the correspondence with Sammarco. As of this recording, he has not replied. It stands out that the correspondence between Dieters and Sammarco came one day after Dieters publicly defended the conviction and, in fact, said,
Elwood Jones is a murderer.
4 days after that, on the morning of December 22nd, Andrea Hatton emailed the Rhoda Nathan autopsy report to Mark Pietmeyer, the now-retired assistant prosecutor. Interestingly, that autopsy report includes the laboratory results showing Rhoda Nathan tested positive for hepatitis B. At 7:57 a.m., Pietmeyer responded that the autopsy describes Nathan's liver as normal, but he assumed Gerber would have seen signs of hepatitis if she'd had the infection. Andrea replied that no, actually, eyeballing her liver wouldn't have shown much, though she worded it more clinically. Quote, apparently it only shows up microscopically, not grossly, unless she was really sick from the infection, so his visual inspection would not yield useful information. End quote. It's clear Pietmeyer knows Sammarco is readying to release her supposed smoking gun test result showing that someone tested negative for Hep B, because he replies, quote, got it. I'm curious to see if the media gives Connie a pass on this. Had she not already dismissed the case with prejudice, the prosecutor could have gone back before Judge Cross and asked her to reconsider her decision to grant Elwood a new trial, as the hepatitis result was the main reason she granted a new trial. End quote. 2.5 hours later, at 10:13 a.m., Sammarco sent out a news release to Cincinnati area reporters saying that Rhoda Nathan had tested negative for hepatitis B. Phone records show that Connie Pillage didn't know this announcement was coming until 10 a.m., just 13 minutes before the press release went out. That's when Sammarco called Connie Pillage. That call lasted 3 minutes. So to recap the timeline, the coroner spent days communicating with the former prosecutors who had just publicly attacked Pillage's decision. The current prosecutor, Pillage, the one with actual authority over the case, got a 3-minute heads-up call 13 minutes before the announcement. Like I said, it's curious. Now, back to the medical claim itself. Sammarco, in her news release, said her conclusion was based on the autopsy showing no liver inflammation. She said a pathologist reviewed the microscopic findings, found no inflammation, and therefore concluded that Nathan could not have had hepatitis B. Except that's medically wrong. As Andrea Hatton had already explained in an email to Pietmeyer, but let's not only take Hatton's word for it. According to the American Association for the Study of Liver Diseases, hepatitis B does not always cause visible liver inflammation. In what's known as the immune-tolerant phase, patients can have no inflammation or fibrosis but high levels of viremia, meaning an active infection with no visible liver damage. Why? Well, because the virus itself doesn't damage liver cells. The inflammation comes from the immune system fighting it. In certain phases of infection, you can absolutely have hepatitis B without inflammation. Still, Sammarco cited that lack of inflammation as proof Rhoda did not have hepatitis B. She quickly amplified that view through radio and television interviews, which much of the media largely treated as though it undermined Pillage's decision. The Cincinnati Enquirer, my former employer, was an exception, by the way. Online forums erupted. Some suggested that Elwood Jones should spend the rest of his life looking over his shoulder, as though he's not already doing that. Now, the next day, as I said, Sammarco walked it all back. In a written statement on December 23rd, she acknowledged that the laboratory report showing a negative hepatitis B result actually belonged to Elwood Jones, not Rhoda Nathan, and that the correct report showing Nathan was positive had been provided to her by Jones's attorneys. She thanked attorney David Hine for providing what she described as new-to-her documentation. But here's the thing. The hepatitis B result wasn't some separate lab report that got lost. It was a test conducted by the coroner's office. It was included in the autopsy. It was in my files on the case. I don't understand why it wouldn't have been in the coroner's files. Pillage's office put things more bluntly. Quote, "The coroner did not uncover new information about the victim's medical history. This was a misreading of a test done through the coroner's office," end quote. Now here's another thing my FOIA request showed me. The same day of Sammarco's initial announcement, phone records indicate the coroner's office was in contact with multiple media figures. Among them, a text exchange with TV reporter Tricia Mackey, in which Mackey referred to Jones as a quote-unquote guilty man Connie Pillage had set free. There was also contact with Bill Cunningham, the talk radio host who had aired the December 17th defense of the conviction, and later that evening, communication with Tanya O'Rourke, a local reporter who also happens to be the wife of Joe Dieters. In another text exchange, WCPO reporter Valerie Lyons told Sammarco she had gotten the coroner's cell number from Tanya O'Rourke. When Lyons wanted to discuss the hepatitis B announcement, Sammarco replied that she would rather talk on a landline, and her message, Sammarco included, one word, quote, anonymous, end quote. As I mentioned, my records request for landline call logs was denied. Now, for the sake of transparency, I'll mention that I find some of this unusual, but I'm not assigning motive. Anonymous, for example. It's unclear what Sammarco meant. This could have been explaining that her landline wouldn't show caller ID, or it could have indicated a desire to keep the conversation off the record. Now, before I walk through the rest of Dieters and Pete Meyer's radio claims, I need to address something that happened on Christmas Eve, because it's already being used to muddy the waters about the 1994 conviction. On December 24th, so the day after Sammarco walked back her explosive news that got online forums literally calling for Elwood Jones' lynching, he was charged with operating a vehicle while impaired, failure to control a motor vehicle, and leaving the scene of a crash. According to police, Jones drove onto a sidewalk, struck a light pole, left the scene on foot, returned about 30 minutes later, and refused an alcohol test. His attorney entered a plea of not guilty on his behalf. Of course, if those charges are proven, he'll face, and arguably deserve, the consequences. Driving under the influence is dangerous. Someone could have been seriously hurt or even killed. Nothing about Jones's past makes that acceptable. But this is also where things often get blurred in public discourse. A bad decision in 2025 does not retroactively make someone guilty of a murder in 1994. It does not cure Brady violations. It does not turn flawed forensic theories into sound ones. And it doesn't justify false or misleading statements by public officials. Two things can be true at the same time. Elwood Jones can be accountable for what happened on Christmas Eve, and the system can still have gotten his murder conviction wrong. Now, as people discuss Elwood's case online, they often repeat claims Dieters and Pete Meyer made during the Cunningham radio appearance. So for the rest of this episode, I'm going to address those. Claim: only four people had master keys. Rhoda was staying in a hotel room with two friends, Elaine Shoup, who had been her best friend forever, and Elaine's boyfriend, Joe Kaplan. The hotel room door was the type that locked automatically when you pulled it closed. Kaplan told police he's certain he tested the handle to ensure it was locked when he and Elaine left the room to go to breakfast, leaving Rhoda behind to shower. When they returned to the room half an hour later, the door was locked again. But when they opened it, using an old-fashioned key, because this was before electronic pass cards, they found Rhoda fatally beaten and lying on the floor. This is Pete Meyer talking.
Immediately, when Blue Ash started investigating, they realized one very important thing. Whoever did this had to be in the hotel that morning and had to have a master key. And that limited the suspect pool from hundreds of people in the hotel to about four people.
The reality: For starters, police don't know who all was in the hotel when Rhoda Nathan died because, based on hotel guest questionnaires and interviews with the hotel's dedicated shuttle driver, some employees and suspicious people left the hotel around the time Rhoda was killed. Second, the hotel was notorious for not keeping close tabs on its master keys. During my investigation, I documented that key control was lax. Employees who quit or were fired often weren't asked to return their keys. The claim that only four people had access is false and serves to make their case sound airtight when it wasn't. Additionally, multiple thefts had been reported in the months leading up to Rhoda's death, and those thefts continued after Elwood's arrest. Some of the victims of those thefts said someone gained access to their locked hotel rooms and stole items while they were out of the room. One person even reported that he was in the room when someone who appeared to be a staffer tried to enter without knocking at an hour that made no sense for it to be housekeeping, and the staffer was only stopped from coming into the room because the hotel guest had used the interior chain lock. Now, police did create a spreadsheet looking at Jones's schedule and trying to match it up with reported hotel thefts, but they never conducted that type of thorough analysis of other employees' schedules. And by the way, Jones wasn't always at the hotel when those thefts took place. I found at least one employee who wasn't scheduled to work the morning of the murder, but was there in uniform anyway. Another employee's alibi, verified by checking event schedules, fell apart under scrutiny. Claim: the withheld documents were immaterial. Here's Dieters.
We had the trial. It went through all the judges in state court, affirmed. Then they go to federal court. And when they went to federal court, they asked for all these documents from Blue Ash Police, were basically questionnaires given to everybody who stayed at the hotel. The vast, vast majority was, we didn't see anything, okay? That's the thousands of pages of evidence that was hidden. And then police runs to the hotel. The federal court of appeals, the judge at the trial level, said that the material was in fact immaterial and it would not have affected the outcome of this trial. Then it went all the way to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, federal court of appeals, on the same issues. Exact same issues, and they unanimously affirmed that too.
The reality: Hamilton County Common Pleas Judge Wendy Cross found that prosecutors had committed Brady violations by withholding nearly 4,000 pages of investigative documents. That's one of the reasons she ordered a new trial. The documents included witness statements about suspicious men near Nathan's hotel room, tips about alternate suspects with violent criminal histories, and documentation that key physical evidence was not as unique as prosecutors claimed. So these weren't all just questionnaires where people said, we didn't see anything, as Dieters characterized them. Some were, sure, but others were substantive investigative leads that weren't just followed up on by police, but they were never shared with the defense. Now, yes, appellate courts had heard about some of the documents before, but they came out in dribs and drabs as Jones's various defense lawyers over the years fought for more and more discovery. Along the way, appellate panels indeed said, yeah, this stuff should have been turned over, but on its own, it likely wouldn't have swayed the jury. Judge Cross's 2022 hearing was the first time all of these withheld documents were presented together, cohesively in very thick organized binders, with defense experts arguing that they were both Brady violations and showed evidence of tunnel vision on the part of police and prosecutors. On top of that, during Cross's hearing, new evidence was presented: Jones's most recent hepatitis B testing, and also testimony about a tip about an alternate suspect that a woman said she called in back in 1995 that was ignored. We'll talk more about that in a bit. Claim: the walkie-talkie matched the bruise. I'll let Pete Meyer explain this one about rectangular bruises found on Rhoda's chest.
There was a couple of distinctive bruises that were developed on her body. One was very consistent with a walkie-talkie, which some of the workers in the hotel were issued. Elwood Jones was one of those. They found a walkie-talkie that actually Joe and I went to Washington, D.C. and had the FBI lab look at it, and they were able to match it. Again, it's a walkie-talkie. There were more than one in that hotel, but it matched all the rivets and everything, matched exactly the mark on Rhoda Nathan's chest.
The reality. This was one of the oddest moments when I initially reported the case. In 2019, an Inquirer intern and I interviewed Peter Alderucci, one of the homicide investigators in the case. Here was that exchange.
The walkie-talkie, almost all the employees had those, right?
Yes, but there's like a fingerprint. The scratch marks on those screws are going to be different for everybody. You know, you put your phone, your walkie-talkie in a charger, it's going to get scratched a little bit. No two are going to get scratched exactly the same. Just like I examine shoe prints.
But did you look at all the other walkie-talkies then to determine whether they had those scratch marks?
They all had scratch marks, but they're all different.
But did you,
We looked at others. We didn't send them to the FBI.
Because, just the one was.
Yeah. Just like a fingerprint. I would look at one fingerprint, and if it matched, it matched. No two are alike.
But and was it? Go ahead.
I'm sorry. It's not a fingerprint.
No.
Not as,
but even a shoe print.
It doesn't have a history.
No, but even a shoe print, when I taught in the police academy, I taught everybody could have the same pair of shoes on, same tread design, everything. I could have you all marching together, you know, over the same black top or whatever for a day or so, come back, and everybody's shoe is going to be worn a little different. It's going to have little cuts in it. They're going to be different. That's the same way with the screws. It's just unreasonable to think that two screws are going to scratch exactly the same way. It's just not logical. It's not possible.
By the way, this is not what Pete Myers said in 2019 when Amanda, intern Mark Rosenberg, and I interviewed him. Back then, he said,
DNA is conclusive. Fingerprints are conclusive. Bruise marks like this are not conclusive, and we don't try to pass them off that way.
He also said,
they could not say it was made by his walkie-talkie.
He's right. Or the 2019 version of him is right anyway. Bruises are not fingerprints. Imagine you've slammed your leg into the corner of your coffee table. Most of us have done that before. You get a bruise on your leg, maybe even worse, a contusion or a hematoma. You might see some general characteristics that point to your coffee table having left the mark, and maybe there's a darker spot where the sharp tip of the corner hit your leg. Let's say now, though, that there's a scratch on your coffee table. Your dog left it there 2 years ago. It's the kind of mark that makes your coffee table unique when compared to another identical coffee table that's been sitting in someone else's house for a while, right? Fair. There's an identifying mark on your table. But do you really think you're going to see that scratch within your bruise? That's just not how bruising works. Bruise pattern analysis, especially matching bruises to specific objects, is notoriously unreliable. Skin is malleable. It bunches and pulls and reacts differently based on whether the bruisee is thin or fat or standing or prone. And unlike fingerprints or DNA, bruises change shape as they develop. The amount of force can vary. Sometimes you've hit that coffee table and gotten a big bruise, right? Other times, you barely see it. Alderucci told me that tiny scratches on the bottom of Elwood's walkie-talkie also showed up on Rhoda's body. That, he said, was proof that only Elwood's walkie-talkie could have created those bruises. Yet he also told me that no one else's walkie-talkie had been analyzed, so that means they looked at one walkie-talkie and just went, yep, lines up, without even looking at the other staffers' walkie-talkies to say, ooh, here's a unique mark on this one that proves this wasn't the weapon. To be clear, if they had done that, it would still be dubious, but they didn't even try. Also, there's no scientific way to do comparison tests to show that any walkie-talkie, much less Elwood's specific one, left those bruises. I know this because during my accused investigation, I contacted experts to see how I could try. See, in season 3 of Accused, we built a replica of the salt vat in which the victim died. I wanted to do a similar type of experiment for season 4. So I called around to experts, including the infamous body farm I'd read about in the book Stiff, and asked if there was a way to do it. No, they said, of course not. You can't test it on dead bodies because they don't bruise like live bodies. And you can't test it on a live body because you'd hurt the person. I said, well, what about on pigs? They have similar characteristics to humans, right? The lady I spoke with was like, you want to hit a live pig? That was the point I realized how ridiculous the question was. Of course not. There's no ethical way to test this out. But what we do know is that the size and shape of this bruising is consistent with a walkie-talkie, but bruising does not show the minute details Pietmeyer and, previously, Alderucci claimed. You can see shapes, you can say something is consistent with a bruising pattern, but you can't line it up with the precision they're describing. Similarly, Pietmeyer mentioned bruising potentially coming from the chains the hotel guests would use to lock their doors from the inside.
There was also a door chain, a latch, which is kind of an unusual mark to have on a body. She also had that on her body.
He presented this as though some expert conclusively identified that bruising as matching a door chain, but that's a mischaracterization of what the original expert testified to. This is military pathologist William R. Oliver being questioned by lawyers in a videotaped deposition shown to jurors.
We talked about, I think it was 12B, exhibit 12B.
Yes, sir.
And that was a sort of a chain affair, some kind of a link.
The marks are simply ellipses.
They're not necessarily a chain. So you don't really know whether the source of those marks, do you? Whether they're a chain or whether they...
A few minutes later...
In Area B, that your report stated that that does not imply a chain?
That the marks do not imply a chain.
Correct.
Honestly, this is a tricky position for a journalist because I straight up don't know what to make of Dieter's and Pietmeyer's radio comments here. This wasn't a situation where there was a battle of the experts on the stand and I'm just choosing to share the defense expert's position. This was the expert tapped by the state to do comparisons on this evidence because he had more experience than the county investigators had. He never said the bruising matched a chain.
Big savings are in the air. Don't miss your chance at 15% cash back during Rakuten's Big Give Week. Shop and get rewarded at your favorite stores like Adidas, KitchenAid, Expedia, and hundreds more. So go ahead and refresh your closet, spruce up your home, book that trip, and much more. But 15% cash back is only from May 4th to the 11th. So join now. Go to Rakuten.com or download the Rakuten app and join for free and start saving. That's Rakuten.
Claim the alternate suspect confession is worthless.
This was first came to light, I think, from one of his attorneys 20 years after the murder happened. But they had a lady who said back around that shortly after this happened, she was locked up in the Justice Center and her cellmate was a lady. I think her name was Linda Reed. And they get to be talking, kicking a little bit. And Linda Reed tells this lady, I have to tell you something. You know that person that's been arrested on that Embassy Suites case? Yes, yes. Well, my husband, the one who really did it, and the Blue Ash police framed that guy for it.
There's more to this quote, but let's pause here for a minute. Some of this is accurate. There was a woman in 2016 who reached out to Jones's defense team because her mother had been watching a TV show about wrongful convictions that triggered a memory. Dolores Suggs recalled that when she was in jail on some piddly charge back in 1995, she met Linda Reed, who at some point told her that her husband killed a woman in a hotel and framed a black man for it. 20 years later, Dolores told her daughter that she had called police with this tip, but they had brushed her off, saying, "We already have the guy who did this." Dolores, who wasn't a big fan of cops to begin with, didn't want to make waves and dropped it. Her daughter, Tierra, looked up the case, found that it must have been the Elwood Jones case because the timing and the hotel info checked out, and she's the one who messaged Jones's lawyers. Dolores testified in 2022 that she had called police about this tip before the trial in 1995. Police testified that they would have written it down, so therefore, Dolores was lying about making that call. But here's the thing. Even with a tip line set up, Police weren't able to produce any documentation of calls to the department with information about this case. How could they be so sure Dolores didn't call? Every case with a tip line tends to get some calls, and this was a high-profile case. Experts for the defense said in 2022 that police's claim they didn't get Dolores's tip wasn't reliable since they couldn't produce any call logs at all. Now, we'll go back to Pete Meyer.
Number one, he didn't work for Blue Ash Police. Number two, there's no association with him in the hotel. When I pull the file, I see it's Ken Peller, guardian for Linda Reed. Ken Peller's a local attorney, guardian for Linda Reed versus Mr. Reed. And I'm thinking, why does she have a guardian? I mean, why is she not participating in the divorce? So I look further and actually contacted Ken Peller. He says she was incompetent. Mentally incompetent to participate.
The reality, Pillage didn't mention Earl Reed in the presser about dismissing charges at all, except to say that information about an alternate suspect wasn't given to the defense. I actually don't know anyone in the case, including the defense lawyers, who would pin their reputations on Earl Reed having killed Rhoda Nathan. I mean, I'd love to ask Earl about the allegations, but both he and Linda Reed are dead. What I can say is that one of the hotel guest questionnaires not given to the original defense team included a description of a man hustling away from the hotel just before Rhoda's body was found. That witness said the man left through a door that should have been locked but was propped open by a plastic cup, and her description of him aligns with Earl Reed. Tall, lanky, ruddy, and white. He was moving swiftly in the direction that, according to Google Maps, was the same direction of Earl Reed's home at the time. Now, does that mean he killed Rhoda? Of course not. This is a long-shot theory. The defense team never said he did it. They simply argued that Dolores Suggs' tip should have been passed on to Jones's defense team, as all potentially exculpatory information is supposed to be. Claim Pillage colluded with the defense attorneys. Here's what Dieter said.
I mean, she's parroting the talking points of the defense attorneys.
Which is a good thing sometimes.
Well, for you maybe, but she's supposed to be representing the state of Ohio. And, you know, and I know this is kind of personal in nature, but I was the prosecutor and I litigated this case for 25 years and she clearly talked to the defense attorneys. She was in her press conference. She said, oh, I sent him a screenshot of my motion to dismiss the whole case, you know, almost gleefully. And she never called me one time.
The reality, before the hastily announced press conference dismissing charges, Pillage had only met with defense lawyers once. And to be frank, the lawyers were kind of ticked about it. I reported that in an earlier episode. They had hoped that after she was elected, she would follow through on the sit-down she had promised them while she was campaigning. For almost a full year, that didn't happen. As a reporter, I can tell you, I heard grumblings from not just those defense lawyers, but others throughout the city who worried that she had turned her back on this case and others for fear of alienating longtime assistant prosecutors. She couldn't afford a mass exodus as a new boss, especially not when she's the first Democrat to hold the county prosecutor post for more than 90 years. And Pete Meyer himself stayed on to help with Pillage's transition.
You know, I did my best to help with the transition, you know, just so because I cared about the office, I cared about the county.
Jones's lawyers didn't know the dismissal was coming. They hoped their most recent motion to dismiss would sway her, the one that hinged on the fact that the office certified already that their case was futile unless Officer Mike Bray's testimony was allowed to be introduced. But they told me that they assumed she would simply say, we don't have enough evidence anymore. He served nearly 30 years on death row. We're giving up this fight. Instead, she said far more than that. It is true that she alerted the lawyers by texting a screenshot of her motion to dismiss right before the press conference. That part is accurate. But what it means is that she didn't even give them a heads up of what was happening. I and a handful of other reporters at that press conference knew the charges had been dismissed before the lawyers did. Lastly, and this is the part of the interview that could potentially lead to consequences, there's this. Claim, Jones can still be called a murderer.
Mark, Pete Meyer, did Elwood Jones murder Rhoda Nathan?
Yes.
Elwood Jones is a murderer. We had the right guy. Absolutely, positively sure.
The reality, there is no conviction. The charges are dismissed. The sitting prosecutor says she believes Jones is innocent. Yet a sitting Ohio Supreme Court justice went on talk radio and called Jones a murderer as a statement of fact. This potentially violates both civil defamation law and the rules governing his conduct as a justice. Let's break this down. We'll start with the defamation risk. Calling someone a murderer when there's no conviction to point to is a factual assertion that Jones committed a crime. That's potentially defamatory. Jones might need to prove actual malice, that Dieters either knew the statement was false or showed reckless disregard for the truth. But when the sitting prosecutor has declared she believes Jones is innocent, when medical evidence contradicts the prosecution's theory, and when all charges are dismissed, continuing to assert Jones is a murderer could meet that standard. Then there's the judicial ethics issue. Dieters began the interview by noting he had recused himself from any ruling on the Jones case. For starters, he only did that after Jones's lawyers insisted he do it. Let's set that aside. Recusing from deciding the case while simultaneously spending an hour on talk radio defending his prosecutorial handling of it could create what Ohio's Code of Judicial Conduct calls the appearance of impropriety. Rule 1.2 requires judges to, quote, act at all times in a manner that promotes public confidence in the independence, integrity, and impartiality of the judiciary, end quote. The test is objective. Would this conduct, quote, create in reasonable minds a perception that the judge violated this code or engaged in conduct that reflects adversely on the judge's honesty, impartiality, temperament, or fitness to serve, end quote. So consider what Dieters did. Question the sitting Hamilton County prosecutor's competence and integrity, positing that she's either ignorant or a liar. He defended his own prosecutorial record on cases that may come before him for review. He called a defendant a murderer after all charges were dismissed. Wrote a letter to both Pillage and the Ohio Attorney General insisting, quote, Elwood Jones is no innocent victim of circumstance. He is a career criminal, end quote. Dieters told Cunningham,
I sent this letter to the Attorney General's office today also, because if he makes this ridiculous claim, they'll at least know where to go to talk to about the facts of the case.
That letter creates another potential problem. Elwood Jones is filing a wrongful conviction lawsuit. The state is in charge of doling out those damages, hence the reason Dieters sent his letter to the Attorney General. Ohio Judicial Code Rule 2.10a prohibits judges from making public statements that, quote, might reasonably be expected to affect the outcome or impair the fairness, end quote, of matters that are pending or impending in any court. A civil lawsuit is clearly impending here, yet Dieters spent an hour on conservative talk radio insisting Jones is guilty, sent a detailed letter to the Attorney General mischaracterizing the evidence, and attacking the dismissal. These statements could poison any jury pool and certainly create the appearance that he couldn't be impartial if this case reaches his court. And then there's this. Pillage is likely to bring cases before the Ohio Supreme Court. How can Dieters be viewed as impartial when he's publicly attacked her? Now, will anything come of this? The Ohio Board of Professional Conduct can investigate judicial misconduct complaints, but the Ohio Supreme Court has final authority on discipline. That means Dieters' colleagues, five of whom are fellow Republicans on a court with a 6-1 Republican majority, would decide whether his conduct violated judicial ethics rules. I'm not holding my breath. But misstatements of fact told on one of the biggest radio shows in Cincinnati deserve to be fact-checked. Rhoda Nathan's memory deserves the truth, not convenient narratives. And all of this is likely to come up again the next time Dieters or Pete Meyer claim someone is absolutely, positively guilty. What If They're Wrong After the Accusation is a production of Just Us Media and Grab Bag Collab. It's reported and hosted by me, Amber Hunt. Amanda Rossman is the producer. If you like what you hear and want to support this kind of investigative journalism, please rate and review us and tell all your friends where to find us. And please consider supporting our subscription-based network at grabbagcollab.com, where you get access to this show early and ad-free, plus several others.